Thank you very much, Fred. It's actually much worse than you think, as far as the God of the Old Testament is concerned. Let me take you back about when I was just starting as a minister in evening service in Redcliffe Bay Methodist Church. Congregation, 12 old ladies, myself and a gentleman called Mike, who was an ex-Royal Naval officer, wonderful voice, and he was reading the lesson, which was Deuteronomy 24, beginning at verse 10, which is a very nice piece of what's called the Holiness Code in Deuteronomy, which tells you to be nice to immigrants, because that's in there as well, and widows and orphans. Only because of the layout of the New English Bible, he began reading at Deuteronomy 23, verse 10. If one of you is unclean because of what happens to him at night, he shall go outside and wash himself, because I will have nothing unclean within my camp. Now, the congregation began to wake up here. They didn't know all this stuff was in there. You shall have a towel among your equipment. And when you are caught short, or some other banal expression, you shall dig a hole and squat and relieve yourselves. I shall have nothing unclean among my people in my camp. Now, I was thinking at this point, how am I going to preach on this? It's very interesting. And then he went on to describe in some detail some of the sort of verses that you find so objectionable. In this case, what to do with male temple prostitutes. Now, the male temple prostitute was a species of person which most of the congregation didn't know existed. And they were intrigued and fascinated. So it's all in there. You're right. I will come back, if you want, to your reading of the scriptures, which I have to say to you, I'm afraid, is very inaccurate and impartial, based on Kautsky's somewhat banal appropriation of Christian biblical criticism in his own country, Germany, which was, well, that's a big topic. We might come back, if you want, to the Gospels and their role, but I don't want to do that. I want to start with some areas of agreement that I think we have between us, Marxists and Christians. By the way, for my own background, I was brought up as an atheist.
That's good.
My family's roots are in Northern Ireland, which we left when I was about 8, came to England. I lost my accent, it was beaten out of me, quite literally, in an English school. And my father was an atheist. His father, my grandfather, had read Nietzsche, and had come to the conclusion that the churches only speak like that because they have no claws. That Christianity was, as Fred I think has pointed, a Sklavenmoral, the morality of slaves, by which the slave brings down that which is noble and good and true by appealing to the guilt and the weakest side of the Übermensch, the person who really moves societies. Let's not go into dialogue with Nietzscheans. I've had a lot of that in my time. But my father was an atheist. But he, my goodness, he was a Protestant atheist. And I do fully agree with you with the way that Christianity can be appropriated as a tribal badge of identity. And it is clearly nothing to do with the genuine article. What is the genuine article? What links Gene Robinson, the gay bishop of wherever it is in the States, an Ethiopic monk, and, I don't know, a redneck, what's the name, Palin, you know, what links them, I don't know. I can't speak about them, but I will try and talk to what Richard Baxter called mere Christianity. Some basic ideas, which I think, in many ways, align us with Marxism. After all, what links a Poom militiaman in 1938 to Chinese Red Guard in 1968 and a member of the International Marxist Workers in 2008. Well, they are all recognisably, I think, in some ways Marxist. They're working to a tradition. And I'm so glad the tradition has survived, by the way. I thought you'd all died out. Thank God you're all here. Firstly, the first, and actually in many ways the most important area of agreement will surprise you. Barclayan idealism, which Fred referred to in such an erudite and helpful way, is an aberration. I mean, Barclay was trying to defend Christianity against a very crude materialism, and he just turned their arguments rhetorically brilliantly on their head. But this is not mainstream Christianity. In fact, mainstream Christianity is not strongly dualistic. That is to say, just as Marxists talk about matter and mind, but they are referring to very much two sides of one coin, if Christianity talks about spirit and substance, or spirit and the flesh, it's not talking about two separate opposed things. It's talking about two sides of the same coin. There is only one reality. We do not think that there is this hidden veil thing that in this world we must bow to and is superior. There is the one reality. And this is signalled in classical Christianity by the rejection of something called Docetism. Now this is a doctrine about Christ. And it comes from the Greek word doketai, meaning to seem. And there were those in the early churches who taught that Christ was a divine being, as it were, disguised in a thin veil of humanity. And this doctrine is decisively rejected whenever it is discussed. No, the Orthodox confession is that Christ is fully human and fully divine. A much more difficult and paradoxical teaching. But the church has to cling to it because it wants to assert that he is bone of our bone, flesh of our flesh. That this world is real. That he bled and suffered and had a runny nose. He really was human. Docetism is rejected. And another difficult doctrine, in the context of the Greek world where the accepted notion was, as the Greeks put it, soma sema, the body is a tomb. That what is real within us is this immortal spark, which when we die is released. The church decisively rejects that and teaches and proclaims the much more difficult doctrine of the resurrection of the body. A much more difficult, but in fact the only philosophically comprehensible account of a life after death that I can get my head round is the idea that, as it were, we would continue in some way embodied. Because the only human life I know is an embodied life. I can't conceive of some sort of spiritualist concept where, you know, heaven is just like Neasden, but there's not so much traffic. You know, I mean, that just makes no sense. We float around, you know, ectoplasm. The resurrection of the body. And these doctrines signal that the church is not committed to a strong dualism, just as Marxism is not. And it follows from that an even deeper agreement. History counts. History is important and meaningful. We can tell, as it were, a story about history. And Marxists tell your stories. And we tell our story. And we are, interestingly, both held to account and embarrassed by history. Marxists are embarrassed by the fact that actually the final crisis of capitalism keeps on seeming to postpone itself. I mean, you might be a bit more hopeful now. Yeah, well, I can see that, yes. But nevertheless, be prepared to be disappointed. We certainly are disappointed by the failure of the parousia, the second coming of the Lord Jesus.
Which also keeps getting put off.
It also keeps getting put off. You see, we're in the same boat, friends. Because for us, actually, and I don't mean to be at all flippant here, history counts because there is only one reality. And here we are very clearly together against, say, the representatives of Eastern religions, in which history is cyclical, repeats itself, is going nowhere in particular. That certainly is the Buddhist and Hindu account. and perhaps more seriously against those postmodernists who distrust all these things they call meta-narratives. Yes, we are together. And this, of course, explains, and I perhaps if we have more time in the question and answers, I can talk about the deep engagement between Christianity and Marxism in South America and in Asia, which I think actually, Fred, goes far beyond what you're talking about. That the churches are institutionally oppressive, oh, believe you me, I do agree. I experience it all the time. But even given that, the Roman Catholic Church in South America has produced the likes of Helder Camara, Gustavo Gutierrez, Oscar Romero, shot by right-wing death squads on his, as he celebrated Mass, because of his insistence on the option for the poor and his challenging, in a very Marxist way, the institutions and ideologies of the San Salvadorian state, the El Salvadorian state. We can talk more about that later, I hope we will. I was taught by Dennis Turner, a Catholic theologian in Bristol in the 1980s. Turner puts forward the thesis that just as in the 13th century, the church adopted the Aristotelian philosophical synthesis, mediated to it by Averroes and Avicenna, the Islamic philosophers. So now, in the 20th, as it was then, 20th century, Marxism is the philosophical framework which the church must use to understand the world. Now, I actually don't agree with him completely at all, but nevertheless, there is enough in his thesis to be deeply challenging and helpful to the Christian church. You have challenged and helped us if you are Marxists. We understand more of the truth because of your insistence on things like ideology and the way that groups can speak for their class interests in disguised ways, and the importance, yes, of the class struggle and of the contradictions inherent in systems, which are the motive for change, but then which produce other contradictions in their turn. All this we have found profoundly helpful, I think. So, Christianity, then, is clearly communist. What about the Vatican? And the evangelical right in the US? Well, clearly, these are embarrassing counterexamples. For anyone who wants to suggest that Christianity is always of the left or progressive. So I have to say to you, as a Methodist minister, I suspect that almost all my colleagues would describe themselves as such, politically. But the reason these counterexamples exist is because of our profound differences with Marxism, but also with capitalism. And I want to suggest briefly that these are not primarily about theology, but about anthropology. About the Christian account of what it means to be human, which is quite distinct from that of the Marxist, who paradoxically, or at least of Marx, let's talk about Marx, though interestingly, Marx seems to me to have a great deal in common with Adam Smith in their basic understanding of what it means to be human. For both Marx and the classical economists whose insights he developed, man, and it is of course man, for all those thinkers who so undervalue the work of women and its contribution to the welfare of the race, man's plight comes from his economic activity being in several ways stolen, alienated, sometimes in gross ways, starvation, wages, etc., sometimes in more subtle ways, his work being made boring and uncreative. To be liberated and restored, man, above all, proletarian man, who has been trained and disciplined in the very capitalist system, that has enslaved him, becomes aware of his plight, and then as capitalism collapses, expropriates the expropriators. Well, you know all this stuff, don't you? Now, in this analysis, there is so much that is true and decent and humane. And Marx is not, as some have alleged, bereft of a vision for what it might be like to live creatively without such alienation. But it remains a vision deeply in tune with the Enlightenment's understanding of what it means to be human. It is deeply imbued with a confidence that once we are truly aware of what our self-interest is, we shall act as rational agents and realise those interests properly. And here is a deep agreement with the most convinced of Marx's capitalist opponents. Before you rejoice at the collapse of capitalism too easily, you should ponder what the crisis says about the ability of even the owners of the means of production to act rationally. Take Alan Greenspan, former US Federal Reserve Chairman, one of the prime proponents of that faith in the markets which Noam Chomsky has called the religiosity of the Anglo-American elite. Those of us who have looked at the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity are, he says, in a state of shocked disbelief. Disbelief. He's lost his faith that people will act to protect their self-interests. Because that's his account of human beings. We, once we know, act in rational ways. I suggest that actually that is a confidence shared by Marx. That once you are made aware, once the proletariat realises who it is, how it has been oppressed, then it will act. The revolution will come. And against this account of humanity and society is a seemingly much less optimistic account advanced by traditional Christianity. We do not say, of course, that humanity is irrational, nor that humanity has no access to truth, except that from divine revelation. We don't say that. Science is true. It gives us real insights into the world, as do other forms of knowledge. But what we say is that that rationality is bounded. Bounded in ways which are not altogether, can never be altogether available to us. There's a bias in man, says Chesterton, like the bias in a bowl. When we run crooked. We fail to hit the mark. And actually that precise metaphor of failing to hit the mark is what the Greek word hamartia, used in the Greek Testament for sin, means. It's a metaphor. To sin is to miss the mark, not to quite get there. But by not quite getting there, we make huge messes. Our rationality is bounded. And I suggest to you that if you look at the history to which we both appeal of the last two centuries, that account has a great deal more going for it than the account of Marx and Adam Smith of human nature. Related to this is another thing I haven't perhaps got time to advance, but I will do it very briefly, and that is to say that Marx's belief that we become truly human as we engage in struggle, as in creative interaction with the world, with nature, that is how we become human. Yes, yes, but he ignored another struggle, another interaction with that within. And I'll leave you, because my 20 minutes are up, just with the thought of Socrates, that no one sins willingly by which he did not mean, of course, that often repeated statement by Socrates, he did not mean that, you know, we don't actually enjoy sitting sometimes, but rather that we were unaware, we are always unaware of what the true good is. Because, says Socrates, if we were aware, then we would align ourselves with it, if we just realised. Marx and Smith are confident that we can realise what the true good is, and we will follow it. Christians are far more sceptical.